Friday, everybody, and on today's Topics with Elmo, I promised you on my last podcast that I was kind of a history buff, and well, I'm going to deliver through with that today, and I know that originally I planned on sticking with tech stuff, but you're gonna find some history in there, maybe even some history tech to go with it, or tech history, I should say. So, with that being said, yesterday I brought up this whole Japanese internment camps, and for lack of better words, I tend to call them concentration camps, because that's essentially what they were. But, kind of carrying on with the tradition that I had yesterday, I think I'm just going to give a few facts that and stuff that I've read and researched about these internment camps that a lot of the public didn't know and a lot of people are uneducated about, just simply because it's not taught a lot in, I don't want to say elementary school, the horridness of it. I don't think anybody should teach in elementary school. This is a junior high to high school level of knowledge, and because that it's something that's scary for little kids to even hear about, but you'll understand that when I get through this. All right, number one, during World War II, more than 127,000 Japanese Americans were imprisoned at internment camps in the U.S. That is 127,000. Now, this kind of goes along with fact number two in saying that their only crime was simply the fact that they had Japanese ancestry and were being suspected of being loyal to their homeland. You know, basically saying the government went through and said, you have Asian ethnicity, you're being loyal to your homeland, regardless of whether they had even contacted the homeland or not. They were still tried under that clause. And this was brought on, and because, or this was brought on because there was a fear that if the Japanese invaded the West Coast, this is where one of the largest Japanese populations was along the West Coast. There was the fear that if the Japan invaded the West Coast, that all the Jap Americans would be loyal, not to the U.S. like they should be, but they would be loyal to their homeland. And that created a big problem, knowing that there was so many thousands in that area. You know, and at that time, we didn't have a very, I don't want to say we had, I don't think we had a very large military back in 45. And it was around the time of the draft. I'm not really sure about when the draft started and when the draft ended. I think it was even after World War II. So that's a topic for a later date. The popular opinion and bad advice led to President Roosevelt, and that was Franklin. Franklin Roosevelt signed the executive order, which is number 9066, in 1942, that forced all Japanese Americans into concentration camps. And now, that is the word from the research that I'd done. And it was, I want to say it was a Britannica website. The Encyclopedia Britannica website. No, it was not. It was Wikipedia. Wikipedia. This is what Wikipedia said. This is what I've done most of my research from. So we'll just go with that. It called them concentration camps. A lot of people say, oh, it was just internment camps. Well, I'll get into the detail about what the conditions were. And I may even go into a little more detail toward the ends of this podcast about what the living conditions were in this lifetime, because I've heard it was horrid. So calling them internment camps is basically saying what's happening at the border right now, whether or not the kids are in, families are in cages, that, you know, it's been proven, but why they're in cages, that's the whole other story, and I'm not going to get into that subject because that's just a whole nother level. But this, idea that they were just internment camps, and saying that it was a hotel that was kind of like a slumlord's hotel. No, these were horrible living conditions. And the sad fact of the matter is that the majority of the ones sent to these were born in the U.S. to begin with. And what happened was the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor is what fueled, or helped fuel, the anti-Japanese sentiment that led to Roosevelt's executive order. Now, I think that's really a lot of hogwash. He should have stepped back and thought, you know, are these people actually going to do anything? But then again, I have to think about at that time, Japan came out of nowhere, and knowing what kind of culture they lived, and that it was die in battle or die a coward. So knowing their kind of cultural beliefs and stuff, I could see why he was kind of afraid of it. But does that mean imprison all Japanese Americans? No, I mean, granted, put them on the watch list secretly, but I mean, that kind of would have started the NSA 60 years before its time, or whenever it started. Okay, getting back to the list. More than 60%, or excuse me, 66% of Japanese Americans sent to internment camps in the spring of 1942. Now, just in the spring of 1942, that 66% of Japanese Americans had never even been to Japan. Probably so many percent of them have never even contacted Japan. So, that's, like, why? Like, why track them down? Why put in that taxpayers' money, for one, to go and track these people down, knowing they've never even had any contact with the homeland that you're trying to accuse them of being loyal to? So, that was just kind of, you know, off the wall. Now, also, these Japanese Americans, and this is kind of a little side cool fact, they were also known as the Nisei. I'm probably butchering that. I'm going to apologize if I am. But they were known as the Nisei in North and South America and also Australia. And it basically means born to Japanese people. And, you know, when I was reading this fact, I thought, oh, this is going to be something cool. And then I got to the end, it is born to the Japanese people. I'm like, really? Couldn't come up with something cooler? Anyway, but because the camps were not completed, see, these camps were not even completed by the time Roosevelt signed his executive order, which, one, tells me one thing. Tells me that they premeditated this, like somebody actually wanted this to happen long before it actually did. So that kind of makes me curious about what was going on in the political realm at that time. Was somebody already against the Japanese even before Pearl Harbor, the attack happened? Or was that just, you know, was there a big gap of time in between the attack and this that somebody had already thought, let's put these people in camps and, you know, monitor them? But because these camps were not even completed by the time that he signed the executive order, you know, they started rounding up all these Japanese Americans. And the bad part is, and sorry, I've got a little nasal congestion, but the bad part is, he signed this order, and they weren't completed. So what did they do with them? I mean, they couldn't take them there. I mean, they weren't completed. They actually kind of held them in temporary shelters. Shelters like a stable at a horse racetrack. I'm assuming it's a horse racetrack, because it just said stable and a racetrack. In 1945, I don't think they had very many NASCAR races. So, with that being said, or 1942, excuse me. And I'm assuming that pig races were not a big thing either. I don't even think they still are, but, you know. I just had to clear the air. Okay. The orders to evacuate were posted in Japanese American communities. Many of those affected by the orders sold their land and businesses for fractions of what they were worth. And the reasons they'd done that was simply because they did not know whether that that they would be able to return or not. Simply, you know, they didn't know if they was going to be able to live through this. They didn't know what was going to happen. Or also, if they returned, would their property still be there? Would the government have seized them? Would they even be in fit shape to live in when they got back? So they just went ahead and sold them, took their cash, probably stowed it away. You know, banks, coffee cans, who knows? Well, I doubt that they used banks due to the government seizing their assets, too. And who knows how much they would have got back with that, you know. Japanese America, World War One veterans. Now, this is the real kicker. This is what gets me. And granted, the whole thing fires me up a little bit on the inside that some government agency could be so racist. These Japanese American World War One veterans, okay, they served for the U.S. They fought the German powers, and I think it was the Axis powers in World War One for the U.S. Risked their lives for it. And even those were sent into internment camps. That's crazy. Like, they've already gave their dedication and life to the U.S. government. And yet, the government's going to backstab them and throw them in a prison, basically, anyway. Okay, you know, and in these prisons, there was 10 of them across the U.S., remote areas. I mean, middle of the desert kind of camps. There was no getting away from it. It was in 7 states, 10 camps within 7 states, and these states are California, Idaho, Utah, Arkansas, Colorado, Wyoming, and Arizona. Now, you could imagine, the only one that I could see, and it really all depends on, the only one I could see that not being actual desert land would be Arkansas. Just because California, it has a lot of desert land. So does Idaho, Utah, Colorado, Wyoming, and Arizona. You know, all those places are kind of in the really dry area, except for Arkansas. You know, I guess they just wanted to put one in the middle of the hills just to see how it went. You know, and these camps, you know, I keep talking about how horrible the conditions of living were at the time. The camps had tar paper barracks for housing. Now, if y'all don't know what tar paper is, it is like you have your roof. Your roof is made up of the, what do they call them? Trusses, which is the triangular things that make up the point of your roof shape. Now, across those trusses, they have really thick plywood. And then on top of that, to help to keep from leaking, they put this tar paper. Now, tar paper, what it does is that when it gets really hot, it's got some tar particles in it that kind of melt and just create this barrier of... tar is basically what they use to help bond the rocks together for asphalt on the highways. So it's like this sticky, it's made of so many like fossil fuel chemicals, whatever. It's nasty stuff. And if you ever get it on you, you can hardly ever get it off if you don't have to chisel it off, to be honest with you. But, you know, this tar paper, in a hot sun, it will create this kind of like melted, like hardened barrier on the roof, which if that's really all you've got, it's not very good because it will leak all the time. It's not permanent. It does not create a solid barrier. So with that being said, that was their housing. Now, I don't know if that was just the roof or that was the roof and the walls as well. And if that was the walls as well, I mean, you could imagine how hot it would have got. I mean, that's basically having liquid heat on the outside of your walls, basically. So all that heat radiating, I'm surprised 90% of them didn't die of a heat stroke. And apparently this was also in the mess halls, which is where they ate, and the schools too. So they were just surrounded by this tar paper for insulation. That's basically what it was, and I'm sure it was like ovens in there. But the adults were allowed to work. You know, they were not, that is the difference between the concentration camps and this. The adults were allowed to work if they chose, but they only got paid $5 a day. Now, in 1945, making $5 a day, or I don't know why I keep saying 45, it was 1942, making $5 a day was probably minimum wage, or maybe a little bit under what minimum wage would be to us today, you know. Back then, sandwiches were probably 10 cents, but, I mean, they really didn't have anywhere to use it, so, I mean, what would be the point? And then also, you know, these Japanese people, they had a lot of anger, you know, they were taken away from their families and their homes and friends and just thrown into this prison. And it was often said that it was too hot in the summer and too cold in the winter, and it was making life very difficult, and I can understand that because we've all heard about how cold the desert gets in the winter because there's no hills and trees and all this other stuff that kind of holds in the heat, you know. And it's just dry. That's all it is. It's dry. Nothing there. But these camps were located in areas that also made farming very difficult. You know, I talked about how they were in the desert areas. And I've never tried to grow anything in the desert. But I have a hard time growing stuff in southern Kentucky. So knowing all the rainwater we get here and all the good fertile land that we have, and I still have trouble. There's no way I could grow anything out in the desert area. And so the prisoners ended up having to eat a lot of like grub style meals. And I'm guessing that meant the lower end sea rations that the army men got, like the kind that they would be on the last pickings. Basically got the third class army food. And MREs are not that great. I've had them. I think we could do a lot better for our servicemen as far as food goes. But when you're packing something for kind of on the go and you don't know when you're going to see or even when you're going to be able to be around a campfire again, because, you know, campfires and stoves and stuff, they are basically a signal saying, hey, here I am. You know, that it's just knowing that you're not going to be able to be around that anytime soon, I guess that's the best they can do, really. But knowing that these people ate this lower class of MREs, ugh, you know, just the thought of it kind of makes your stomach curdle. But that's all they had, so I guess if they were starving, they were going to eat it no matter what. Okay, if the U.S. Army eventually, because the Army was in the one in control of this, they were the ones that paraded. I mean, there was no prison guards. It was just military soldiers parading around the grounds, through the grounds, you know, keeping track of what all was going on with these people. And they eventually decided to allow the prisoners to leave if they chose, but they had to choose to join the military. It's kind of like the early stages of the forced draft. But only 1,200 chose that option. And I can see why. I mean, they forced me to be in prison. Why would I go sign up for 2 more years of prison for them? But, you know, at the same time, I also think of this. Like, that's a scary thought. Like, you're already afraid of them being loyal to their homeland. Hey, let's stick them in the U.S. Army so they can attack us from within, which they more than likely didn't. Obviously, they didn't. We didn't hear about it in history. So there's no reason to even suspect that they would. But it's just the thought, like, at the time, like, what were they thinking? If they're already going to be that judgmental against them, why even give them the leeway? There may have even been some rules and stipulations into, like, their character and how they acted on base to whether they could even apply for that, but that's besides the point. President Roosevelt, 2 years after signing this order, he rescinded it. And I guess, I'll be honest with you, I don't know what the word rescinded means. And I think it means started closing it down. The last camp was closed in 1945. Okay, and I guess that's why I kept saying 1945. Just simply because they were closed in 45. And I've gone over these notes a few times, and I guess that number just kept popping in my head. Canada also had camps too, so don't just think that the U.S. was the only person doing it. So Canada almost sent 23 Japanese Canadians to camps in British Columbia. That's 23,000 just to them. You know, and Canada's a very big, very big country. But see, the problem with Canada is there's not a lot of livable land. You go 300 miles up, you got nothing but ice. And so, there's a lot of land there, it's just not livable. But still, 23,000 of their own into camps in British Columbia. And 5,766 Nisei, there's that word again, prisoners renounced, I mean they gave up, they forfeited, whatever, their citizenship because they were sent to these camps, even though they were legal citizens, and even the courts had denied their rights as such, which is really, really sad. And the even worst part is even after the President Roosevelt had admit he'd done wrong in doing this, it wasn't until almost 1968, which was almost 24 years later, or after the camps had been closed, not since they started, but since they closed, in the U.S., that the U.S. government decided to make reparations to those who had lost property due to their imprisonment. And in 1988, these surviving prisoners were awarded $20,000 apiece, and only 60,000 out of the, what was it, 127 were still alive. Only 60,000 were still alive. So it's untelling how many people had died in the camps. Of course, you know, a lot of them probably died afterward. And today, the four largest populations in the world of Japanese immigrants and descendants of Japanese live in the U.S., Canada, Brazil, and Peru. Now, I'd like to go in a little bit deeper and talk about the living conditions and what these prisoners faced during their time there. And some of the stuff I got from this other website, which I will post a link to in the description of this podcast. And it basically says that some of the conditions were 25 people were forced to live in an area that was only mainly in a comfortable realm, supposed to house four. So that's really, really, really just kind of cramped, you know. So I'm assuming they spent most of their time outside, just saying. Because 25 people in a space built for four, that's going to stink after a while. But then again, at that time, they were probably nose blind to each other. But anyway, I'll get this link, and I encourage everyone listening to this to check this website out, because it goes step-by-step detail about what happened. And this is actually not Wikipedia. I looked up another website, and it was kind of going in depth of the lifestyle there. The Wikipedia just kind of just really showed the outline and the history of it, not really exactly what happened. So, this other website, I encourage y'all to check it out. Subscribe to these podcasts if you like them. I hope you do. If you don't, let me know about it somehow, you know? Just tell me what I need to do. I'm going to get back on track tomorrow and start doing my tech podcast again to try to, you know, get back on track. I get sidetracked a lot. There is a, for all those history buffs out there that like that kind of stuff, there is a channel on YouTube called The Great War. I mean, that's the channel name. And it goes in a step-by-step, detailed, day-by-day description of what happened in World War One. Now, that's a pretty interesting topic, you know, because there's so many misconceptions about what started World War One and how it ended, and we can all agree that it was the worst war that we've ever been in. You know, so many deaths, so many hundreds of thousands of deaths across the world. That was horrible. Okay, but I hope y'all like this podcast. Tune in tomorrow for more topics with Elmo. Peace and God bless. Love y'all.